The choices you have to make can be difficult and may alter your life forever. When you're under too much pressure, it's hard to go it alone. Now you don't have to. Whether you struggle with anxiety, depression, time management, family issues, relationships, self-sabotage, guilt, shame, or just need some wisdom and helpful insight, this program is the answer. Healing Conversations with Kamish Nunley. Kamish is a licensed mental health therapist with HealingYourHiddenHurts.com and who also shares her knowledge as an expert author, speaker, and radio personality. You don't have to just survive. You can thrive. Here's Kamish Nunley.
Welcome back to another episode of Healing Conversations. I'm your host, Kamish Nunley, and we have officially been back on air for the third month in a row, and I am so excited. Thank you for all of your questions and comments that you've sent thus far. Please continue to like and share our social media statuses, as that's really helpful for the show. One housekeeping item before we start our show today. Our dialectical behavioral therapy group for both youth and adults will be starting up again on November 7th and will last for a total of 12 weeks. So if you're interested in joining our group, please contact our local office by calling 888-349-1116 extension 1. Okay, now on to the show. Our guest today has an amazing life story of both struggle and triumphs. He truly believes what we say at the end of our every show, that our pain can be used as a purpose, which is beautifully divine. Join me today in welcoming author of Tempting the Devil in the Name of God, The Heavy Hand of Fate, Mr. Howard Beckham. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Thank you very much, Kamish. Pleasure to be here.
Good, good, good. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for our guest today, please contact us at 888-463-6748. Our producers will be standing by. Okay, Howard, thanks again for being here, and I'm really, really excited to have you on the show, both for your healing journey experiences that you can share with our audience, but also to talk a little bit about your profession in astrology. And so I want to kind of, I know it's kind of flipping the format just a little bit, but I'd love to start off with you sharing with our audience about what it means to be a master Vedic astrologer.
All right. Well, Vedic astrology is the oldest form of astrology. Okay. And it's been practiced, I mean, it's been practiced for many thousands of years. The Western system had its inception about 1,700 years ago. So, in a nutshell, it is the system of the ancient Vedic civilization, you know, India. Mm-hmm. And to make a long story short, as far as why it's gaining such interest today in the West, is that if you have a practitioner that it has the experience and knowledge in it and devotes himself to it or herself, okay, the results are phenomenal. It's an incredible system of divination, of being able to understand one's future, basically understanding one's karma, you know, in this lifetime. And having been doing it for so long and having so many clients, I've seen that the information I'm able to help people get helps them with their decisions and helps them in the directing of their life. And it has certainly helped myself and many other people that have had a lot of problems, including the type that I had, and as do many millions of people with addiction.
Absolutely. Now, I said Vedic, so it's called Vedic. What does Vedic stand for?
Well, Vedic, okay? The Vedas are the ancient library, shall we say, you know, of the Indian civilization. And so everything from this time period is called Vedic. It's called Vedic when shall we say, the systems of religion and culture were greatly followed by the populace. And so life was very nice, shall we say, during that civilization, you know, know, during those times. I mean, at this time, you know, things are a little bit degraded everywhere in the world. But it's a wonderful system, and, you know, it speaks for itself.
So you've affectionately become known as the astrologer's astrologist, but you grew up in a Jewish family. What drew you to Indian spiritual philosophy or this whole idea of astrology?
Well, I mean, I think that when I was young, I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, you know, and into the 70s, and I was, after I'd had a lot of problems as a teenager, I think as a lot of kids do, with drugs and whatnot, and I started searching afterwards.
Absolutely.
And I went and I, you know, looked at everything that I could, you know, everything that I could. But when I hit upon hearing A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada,
Wow, you're going to have to repeat that slowly.
Okay. Bhaktivedanta Swami.
Oh, gosh.
Bhaktivedanta Swami, but he was known as Prabhupada, actually. Mm-hmm. He was known all over as Prabhupada, which means the master at whose feet all masters sit.
Mm.
And I had gone to see every guru, you know, that was around. I wanted to hear. I mean, I grew up in a Jewish family, and I used to ask all the questions, and generally didn't get the answers. And so, you know, back at that time, I mean, the Maharishi was around, and, you know, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert became Ram Dass, and, you know, you had Guru Maharaj Ji and Muktananda. Anyway, I went to hear everyone.
Oh, yes. Okay.
I went to hear Prabhupada. Something happened. Mm. Something happened. And it was like a channel to my previous life opened up in my brain, and I knew I was hearing the truth. And so that made me begin to delve further into the Vedic sciences as well. And, you know, the rest is history.
Absolutely. So now I am of Christian faith, and I know that in your previous interviews you talk a little bit about, I think it's Gnostic Christian principles and the spiritual sciences as far as the sisterhood. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, with, you know, Christianity is really, it is a religion of devotion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a religion of faith. We're trying to develop love for God. Jesus preached love of God above all else, love. And this is what bhakti yoga is. And this is what I follow, and millions and millions and millions of Hindus worldwide follow, and it is it's often called the yoga of love, but there are many more similarities than differences, okay? In the philosophy, but that it is really changing one's consciousness, you know, changing one's consciousness and beginning to find out who you really are. So it requires a process.
Right. Absolutely.
It requires a process. So you have, you know, Christianity, you have prayer and contemplation, you know, and such. Well, we also have, you know, this, of course, but yoga is an incredible system which combines the body, the mind, and being able to then calm oneself and to be able to really contemplate and to meditate.
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay.
So it's a really real system, and it is not, you know, in principle, it is really not so much different.
Yeah. And that's what I was really entertaining as you were talking in your previous interview. And I forget what radio station it was on, but you talk about how some of the Christian principles, there is this whole idea, or it's more westernized. But it forgets one general principle within the Christian religion. Do you remember that question on a previous show, or how you would answer what you feel like makes a distinction between the Western Christian philosophies versus others?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of times in the West it becomes more external.
Mm.
It becomes more external than it is internal. People kind of I mean, you see all the politicians wearing their religion on their sleeves, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, I go to church, and I'm a God-fearing man, you know,
mm-hmm.
and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, where, you know, when you are God-conscious, it shows.
Mm-hmm.
It shows in your actions, in your speech, in your daily life, how you treat others, and the goals of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, I think that any really intelligent person can see that it doesn't quite seem congruent. Many people that are mm-hmm. leaders in the West that claim that they're religious right, shall we say?
Absolutely, and you see that fairly often with people. I call it a thought discord or cognitive dissonance when people have one way of believing and another way of acting, and it sounds like very much that you're describing right now is we call ourselves Christians and we go and we follow through with going to church and things like that, but oftentimes we forget about showing our spirituality or allowing our spirituality to be seen through
really,
the behaviors that we have.
Right, and really spirituality there is a oneness. Okay, between us, whereas many people create differences.
Right.
Religion. You know, whether it's race, whether it's the different religions,
right.
economic status. One point is that a person who is on the path of trying to understand, of self-realization, has to learn to see with equal vision.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Not to be prejudiced. We're a lot more alike than we are different.
Absolutely.
Right.
And so do you feel like within astrology, and you talk about the sisterhood or the three, I guess, the spiritual sciences, is
right.
that what you mean when it keeps it all congruent, it keeps it all together?
Well, when I talked about the spiritual sciences, I was talking about Ayurveda, which is a science of healing and is a natural system of healing from the Vedas, you know, practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but practiced all over the world now, but especially in India, where it's from, yoga and Vedic astrology. So Vedic astrology is a system to begin to understand your path, your karma, where you came from,
okay,
you know, and to really, I mean, I've done many baby's charts and had the parents come back to me in 20 years and say, you are awesome, I can't believe this.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So tell me exactly what it is that you do. I heard you mention charting. I've heard mapping. What does it look like for someone to come in and sit with you to explore this ideal of healing?
Well, I cast a chart, and then with an understanding of where, basically I'm looking at the astronomical map at the moment you were born.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of information that it gives me.
Mm-hmm.
So I can basically understand, you know, for the most part, how you think, how you act, what turns you on, you know, what you're successful at, what you've been good at, what you know what I mean? It's pretty much there, you know, it's there to be understood in the horoscope.
Mm-hmm.
And my job is to help a person with their life,
mm-hmm.
right, to become more successful. You know, I mean, let's face it, most of the questions that I get are going to be about economic development, they're going to be about the love life, you know,
yes.
the problems, you know, and so my job is to help others. I mean,
okay.
you know, it's what you do. And to be honest with you, I have a lot of clients that are psychiatrists, counselors, psychologists, you know, because they're very much into, they understand that there's, you know, there's something that not everybody sees, you know,
right.
the mental plane, the emotional plane that's there. And, you know, any place that you can get knowledge and information, we shouldn't turn our nose up at it, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I am in total agreement with that. And so what all do you usually get from the client or colleague before they come in and they sit down with you? Do they share with you their birth date?
Yeah, that's it.
Thanks.
It's the birth date, birth time,
wow.
and the place they were born.
So literally, if I gave you that for me, you would be able to set out, I guess, in my language, a treatment plan for helping me to heal past wounds.
Oh, yeah.
That's interesting.
I would be able to understand what happened and make suggestions.
Okay. Right? Okay.
Right? I mean, that's all you can do, right?
Yes. Oh, yes.
You try to help the person, but they're the ones that act.
Absolutely. How long does it take you to actually be able to do this?
To actually cast the chart?
A couple minutes? Are you kidding me? So if I share with you during break what my information is, you would be able to maybe lay out something during the next break and maybe tell it online on air live?
If you want me to.
That would be phenomenal. I would love something like that.
Okay.
All right. Well, with our first break coming up, we're going to take it, but don't go away. We have more of Howard's journey through addiction and recovery to share. So stay tuned here on Healing Conversations.
Tempting the devil in the name of God will have you sitting on the edge of your seat from beginning to end. However, the thrill of his story is not found in its entertainment value. This story is a reality check for all, and a story about perseverance and redemption. While reading, you will have a bird's eye view and the feeling that you are experiencing them, just as Howard did. Tempting the Devil in the Name of God is an epic that will not soon be forgotten. Tempting the Devil in the Name of God by Howard Beckman, now available from Inspire on Purpose Publishing. On Amazon.com.
The effects of trauma can last a lifetime. Pain, confusion, anxiety, depression, grief. Healing Your Hidden Hurts is a safe, serene environment dedicated to guiding you along your journey toward healing. The compassionate clinicians at Healing Your Hidden Hurts can provide the support, advocacy, and expertise to help you move forward again, regain stability. From fear to faith, despair to hope. Visit HealingYourHiddenHurts.com. Speak to a clinician today. Don't go at it alone. HealingYourHiddenHurts.com.
Now, back to Healing Conversations with Kamish Nunley on TalkZone.com.
Welcome back to Healing Conversations. If you are just joining us today, our guest, Howard Beckman, has shared with us his experiences as a master Vedic astrologer. If you have questions for Mr. Beckman, please contact us at 888-463-6748. Now, during our break, I just gave Mr. Beckman my information because I would love to see what something like this looks like after getting that small piece of information and how accurate it could be. Now, it goes without saying that, of course, he would have to spend more time with me to get a very accurate reading, but I'm just really curious even hearing the general reading of what he comes up with. So, Mr. Beckman, I really do look forward to that.
Okay, well, give you a little taster. It'll be my pleasure.
Now, you share with us in your bio how you had a bit of a rough, you describe it as being an out-of-control teenager, making bad decisions. What was life like for you then?
Well, I mean, I don't think it was that much different than many other, young kids growing up on the East Coast that were, were dropping out so many things. And it was really when I, managed to give it up and started searching for a way to ground myself and get some answer to my questions, when I was very young, because I think that, today, I think it's gotten even worse. But, dysfunctionality seems to increase with each successive generation.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
If we don't have mentors, if we don't have guides during our formative years, right, then...
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is great. So,
what's around us, And it's not always great, It's not always great. So, I think when I turned to the spiritual, finding some spiritual center, that's when I began to, you know, really kind of get my life together. But unfortunately, nothing is easy in life.
Oh, absolutely not.
So no. Let me ask you this, because some of our listeners might, you know, we do have teenage listeners, we have young adults, might be asking some of the same questions that you were asking yourself when you were going through these things. What are some of those questions that you had?
Well, I mean, you know, you know, the thing is that, you know, my feeling that I just don't belong. I had this lack of connection, you know what I mean? I don't feel like I didn't belong in any group, even sometimes even in the world, because, you know, the idea of just, you know, hey, I'm just going to work my whole life at a job and to make money and get more things to put around me, and I felt lost, just completely lost. It's like, well, what's going to feed my soul? What's the, you know, we have a desire to feel loved, right? We, you know, and so if you have this general dissatisfaction with life, and no matter how many times you ask the questions of your mind, you can't really get the answer.
I mean,
what do human beings ask that no other living beings on Earth ask? It's the question, why?
Yes.
Why am I here? Why am I here?
I always say, why me?
Right. Why me? Right. Everybody shakes their fist at the sky. God, why me? Right. So that's the thing. So, you know, when I, you know, went down, you know, finally went down that road and, you know, that slippery slope. I mean, I was taking so much heroin at the peak of what I was doing, and those that, you know, actually do it know that, you know, to shoot a gram or to 2 grams in a day of heroin is phenomenal. You know, I was always on the edge of death. I can't even imagine how many times I must have overdosed.
Wow.
And so why does someone do that? When I came out of all this, I was going like, what made me take... You know, not want to be here. Right? You know, I mean, that's the thing, you know, not want to be here. You know, what was it in that little mental world of mine that didn't allow me to commune with the world around me? That didn't allow me to feel connected? So therefore, the escape, right? When you get the escape, and there is no, you know, shall we say, no more complete you know, pharmaceutical escape and heroin.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
You know? So.
And we're experiencing a large amount of overdosing here in Indiana alone here recently, and they've come out with this drug to counteract overdoses. But, I mean, toddlers are waking up to their parents who are dead and gone, which is horrific. From overdosing on heroin alone. What do you think, because I know there are already many different 12-step programs out there, what do you think for people who are kind of in the midst of what you experience as a lack of connectivity, just needing to feel alive again, needing something to jolt you, how do you think our 12-step programs can be improved or expanded?
Well, I think that, you know, within the 12-step programs, it's really important that everyone, you know, becomes a philosopher, you know, we might say, and to not have, you know, prejudices, shall we say, you know, and also that one thing I always saw in the programs is that, okay, we leave everything up to God, right?
Yes.
Say, okay, one day at a time, we leave everything up to God. God, it's up to you. Well, you have to take charge of your own action. God helps those that help themselves. We've all heard that before, right? Okay? So we have to get that, you know what I mean, that, you know, that program from inside, okay, for recovery. Okay? You know, how do we get out? Because in the beginning, we feel helpless. It's just a feeling of helplessness. You can't stop yourself. You've got to go get a drink or you get the drug, and you're just in the midst of it. So first thing is we need help. I mean, we have to be able to be able to get up in the morning without it. But that's not going to help the feelings of helplessness, the feelings of disconnection. So to get to that feeling of hopefulness, we need help. We need people. We need that connection, right? You know, we need that connection. And we need knowledge. And that's why as many tools as I could find, And within the Vedic sciences of Ayurveda and yoga and Vedic astrology, I found such incredible tools for understanding every single person as an individual.
Mm.
Everyone is an individual. And you can't say, okay, here's the program, you just follow this and that, and you'll be better, you'll give it all up, you know, pull up your bootstraps.
Wow.
It's not like that, is it?
Yes. No, 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 not at all.
No. Wow. Our minds can either be our best friends, if we learn how to make them such, but otherwise they're our worst enemy. Ask any addict. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make small steps, right? You know, it's really important that when you go to meetings, whatnot, that there's honest dialogue, you know, and on, you know, without fanaticism, without religious bias, right? You know, in that, because we need to take small steps toward a new life, and then to create a life where we direct ourselves, right?
Yes.
Not that it's like are weary and you know that feeling where you just feel so weary and tired and oh God, I can't even go on. How am I going to go through another day?
Yes.
Well, sometimes after you know what we you know detox, some may have to go away at least for a while, you know, to create something new, to get your mojo, shall we say, and maybe not get your mojo back. Create something new.
Different, right? Absolutely.
You
more
know,
functional.
Like, right, right. Finding happiness after addiction. So it's kind of like a rediscovery of life's blessing, right? But that's got to come from within.
Yes.
You know, we all you hear the thing about you can look at life as a glass half full or half empty, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we really make it so that we can view ourselves and the world around us as filled with possibilities, if we can see and appreciate, actually, to be in this position, how fortunate I am. How many people aren't as fortunate? And of course, today, all we have to do is turn on the news to see millions and millions of people that, you know, we sure wouldn't want to trade places with them.
Absolutely.
Right?
And, you know, I really like the ideal of making it more individualized. I'm recalling when I was employed at a community health center and the new treatment modality became group psychotherapy, and I always took a strong stance against lumping people into a group. For me, it was for the sake of, you know, quantity over quality, meaning, you know, they were looking at numbers, and of course, therapists, we look at our ability to affect change in a person's life. And I always was strongly advocating against just lumping people into groups because, one, a lot of individuals are not ready for the group dynamic that could exist. And so that's why you get into groups and you start to take ownership of other people's problems. You start to prematurely try to help others when you haven't truly helped yourself. And it really does sound like what you're hitting on in terms of individualizing these programs and making it come from that person could be so very effective, because that's what we do when we sit down with clients. We help them find the answers that already exist within them,
right.
Not necessarily following some anecdotal journey. I mean, we have things that can influence the path of treatment, but we don't necessarily prescribe this overall or overview of what treatment will look like because it changes per person. So I think that, you know, you really do, you have something there. And I know later we're going to talk about your meditation program that you've developed, and talking about your book, Tempting the Devil in the Name of God, which is a really phenomenal name. I can't wait to hear what was behind that. But why do you think drug addiction is so rampant today in the U.S.? Why is this becoming such a problem for us?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, in society, it seems that nobody is well-adjusted. Nobody, you know, and if you look at the younger generation, it's real, you know, what are they getting? What kind of training are they getting, you know, as far as what's important in life? You know, if you go in to a school, and it's been, you know, been many surveys taken, you go in and ask say a second grade class, and you go up there and say, you know, what do you want more than anything in life? You know, what do you want when you grow up? How do you want your life to be? Everyone wants to be rich.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, when I was a kid, you know, one guy wants to be a policeman or a fireman, and oh, this guy's a dad is a lawyer, and you know, I don't really understand what some of the occupations are, but but now everyone's indoctrinated that, oh, I got to be rich.
Yes.
And you know, let me tell you something. I've been doing astrology for so many years, and I have a lot of clients that are so-called rich, you know, as far as their monetary worth.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not any happier than anybody else. As a matter of fact, yes, a lot of times they're unhappier.
Mm-hmm.
They have more mm-hmm. problems. So definitely money is not what gives happiness.
Absolutely.
Okay? You know, but what it does is it creates that illusion. You know, we need enough money so that we don't have to worry about, you know, where am I going to eat and sleep and keep the roof over my head and be able to, you know, live the life I choose.
Mm-hmm.
But to live just for money,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, in things, people become dead inside.
Yeah, it creates an environment of scarcity. I always feel like the generations that we're bringing up always feel like there's never enough. Never enough. And so in order to overcome or fill that void, they start to look for mechanisms to numb, to tap out.
Right.
Is that what you're finding, is that this culture is becoming so much more about? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, without question. I mean, you know, the society leaves us with, you know, with an emptiness. I mean, society is pretty spiritually misguided.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the media kind of brainwashes everyone that the goals of life are money and accumulating things, right?
Yes.
The economy
yes.
is what you should worry about. If
yes.
the economy is doing good, oh, be happy, Kamish. Oh, you should be happy. And if the economy is doing bad, worry, you know? And
yes.
The inequality in education. My God, you know, it's like the education, especially in the inner city, okay?
Mm.
What are you going to tell guys that have been in gangs and this and that, even if they want to quit, even if they want to come out? Hey, go get a job for McDonald's and wear a little pointed cap and ask people, would you like fries with that? Is that going to be their life's goal? You know, so they can make money, a little bit of money? No.
Yes.
You know, they're not interested, right? And the older, you know, it used to be older people were greatly respected for their wisdom.
Yes.
Especially their spiritual wisdom, because they have a lot of experience and they've thought a lot and they've, you know, and hopefully got, you know, some inner experience. But
yes.
Today, the elderly are marginalized. Right,
which is
a burden on the rest of the workforce, right?
Yes, which is honestly, and I don't know if very many people know this, Mr. Beckman, but that's why I got into this field, because I learned about how in the old days, how one person would be appointed as the burden carrier, and they would, you know, get all the burdens from everyone in their tribe, and then they would go do a ritualistic ceremony to get rid of the burdens. And so that's actually what appealed to me when I was thinking about getting into this profession, is that I wanted to serve in that way. Now, of course, through time, it has evolved. But you're so right that we don't have, and we talk about this all the time, we don't have the elders anymore around to kind of feed down just wisdom and intelligence and insightfulness. I mean, we got Snooki from reality TV, you know, winning awards that people like Maya Angelou should have won. And so it just shows you how our culture, how our environment have shifted to being never enough scarcity and money oriented versus desiring more wisdom, desiring to be more Christ-like. You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a matter of false identification. Okay,
yes.
We're identifying with this bag of bones around us, first of all, that this is me, okay, that this is me. And so what I'm then doing is that I'm concerned with eating, I'm concerned with sleeping, I'm concerned with, you know, different things for the body. It's all I'm thinking about. You know, if you look at, you know, what everything is out there, you know, that's telling people, look like this, do this, exercise, like everything is concerned with the body.
Yes.
But what about... You know, what about the real self? What we call, you know, our real identity, the real soul. Even the mind is not us.
Yes.
We're not the mind either. The mind is another, you know, it's like another, element. You know, it's another plane, you know. But we are actually separate from that. And at the time of death, we'll leave this thing. and the mind will go with us, you know. So, you know, we'll still use that and go. But what's really important is trying to gain knowledge. Knowledge without impressions, you know, previous impressions, and to really try to think. And that's what, you know, that I found in yoga philosophy. That, that it's a way to, that people can, you know, can get in, you know, begin to hear yoga philosophy and practice a little bit, and come, and all of a sudden it becomes a wow. And this is in 100% of people that actually put their minds and bodies to it for 3 months, and their lives become changed. And you know, that's pretty big, wouldn't you say?
I think that's humongous, and I'm just recalling so many different things in terms of, you know, just how I practice therapy and what I preach and teach to those around me, being very inclusive of, you know, healing not only the mind, but the body and the spirit, because those are kind of what makes, you know, make us whole, you know. And I'm not necessarily a holistic healer, but I do think that my gift is healing the mind. But you can't heal the mind fully if the spirit and the body are out of whack. And so I do prescribe, like, exercise. I do prescribe yoga. I do prescribe prayer or meditation, along with the things that I'm working with people on. And so before we run out of time for this one, I want to take our next break. And when we return, Mr. Beckman will share with us those facing addiction issues across the globe on how he developed a meditation process that helped him find his inner strength. So stay with us.
The effects of trauma can last a lifetime. Pain, confusion, anxiety, depression, grief. Healing Your Hidden Hurts is a safe, serene environment dedicated to guiding you along your journey toward healing. The compassionate clinicians at Healing Your Hidden Hurts can provide the support, advocacy, and expertise to help you move forward again, regain stability. From fear to faith, despair to hope. Visit HealingYourHiddenHurts.com. Speak to a clinician today. Don't go at it alone. HealingYourHiddenHurts.com.
You're listening to Healing Conversations with Kamish Nunley on TalkZone.com.
This is Healing Conversations, and I'm your host, Kamish Nunley, and our guest today, Howard Beckham, author of Tempting the Devil in the Name of God, The Heavy Hand of Fate, which can be found on Amazon.com, is sharing with us today his insightful information of why addiction exists, his journey to overcoming addiction. And so now, Mr. Beckman, what I kind of like to venture into is letting you finish up what we were discussing previous to going to the break. But I'm also aware that you were imprisoned at some point in Bangkok or in Thailand. Can you describe for us what that was like for you?
Oh, boy, sure. I was, you know, I had actually been arrested in the United States. And first offense, and still they my lawyer could not do a deal, and being an addict, and now at this point being you know, what I call now a merchant of death, being that I was smuggling kilograms of heroin, you know, there was no way. They offered me an absolute minimum of 5 years, and there's no way I could have imagined that. So I left. I just left. You know, my karma, I was seeing the handwriting on the wall. I went to Mexico, and within a few days got arrested there. It was just insane. Went, ended up coming back to Bangkok, and lasted about 6 months or so. And as in the beginning of my book, you know, in the first chapter, it's, you know, my where I lived, I had a compound with a wall around it, and one day I drove back in, and and there was, it seemed like half the Thai army there. So I spent, you know, first some time in a local police station, which is a, you know, a fairly big cell, but with so many bodies in it, they're almost on top of each other. And then spent, I think, about a year in a provincial prison in Chonburi. And that was insane. That was where I was actually part of the time put into an underground dungeon, and I wore shackles on my legs. And these aren't handcuff shackles. They're they weighed about 20 pounds, and they put it over your ankle, and they close it with a sledgehammer on an anvil, you know?
Wow. So,
you read in the book, the conditions were just beyond imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I underwent a lot of physical abuse. But at the core of it, one day I had been beaten to a pulp and thrown back in it, and I decided, you know, I can either give up or I cannot give up.
Mm-hmm.
I decided I'm not giving up.
I'm not
giving up. And my mantra came back. And that mantra, which I chanted, you know, for years, and I had, you know what I mean? I had just let myself slip. And so I began to chant the Hare Krishna mantra. And as I chanted that mantra, it not only began to calm my mind, but it started to make me realize, you're getting out of this.
Okay? Yes, yes.
You're going out of this. You were going. And so, you know, it took years. Okay, but, it took probably months in that hole. And then when I finally got out, I began to try to just pick myself up, right?
Yes.
Started exercising and eating as best I could, And I didn't know how I was going to get out of there, but eventually I did. I did get out on bail. And thought I was going to, you know, be able to once more escape, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For me, you know, I was there, but no such. I was then had the feds come, Americans come see me, and when I was let out on bail, the police took me to an immigration jail because the embassy had confiscated my passport.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so they came to see me and said, well, Howard, we got a choice for you. You can either, we'll take you, we'll have some federal marshals take you back to the U.S. And I said, God, isn't this an awful lot for state charges? I mean, since when do you guys go after people? Because it was state charges.
Mm-hmm.
State charges. We've got four or five federal charges. Two of them are the RICO Act. You know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
It's the, Organized Crime Act.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had charges of international smuggling, distribution of a Class A substance, organized crime. So, well, still I decided if I went back, you know, I had a chance. If I stayed there, I would probably die in prison. So came back. And, I detail all those years in the book. But I continued to pick myself up. And when I finally got spit out of the federal system, I started to pick my life up again.
Yeah.
It wasn't fun, but, hey, I realized that I was so far gone that I needed that.
Yes.
Needed that. I needed to be completely pulled out of that situation and for God to say to me, all right, here's some tough love for you.
I'm so glad that you just said that, because that's what I was thinking in my mind. If this is something, you know, you think about Paul in the Bible and how, you know, he was set apart, and a lot of his doctrines came from when he was serving in the prison and shackled and things like that and beaten himself. And so I'm just remembering when I used to work at a prison, level 4 or 5 prison here in Indiana, and many of the people who were set to be set free were so worried about the mindset that they had adapted while in prison, they started to fear being not in prison physically, but imprisoned in their mind, which they call institutionalization. And so you talk about having this mantra, and you said Hare Krishna mantra, that you use to help you overcome those mental barriers. But what was it like for you, or how do you feel like you survived the mental and physical torment you're describing and being able to write about that in your book?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, most people are strong enough, you find you're strong enough, you'll get through anything. You want to live, right? You want to live. And even though when people say, I just want to die, I can't take it anymore, somebody said, okay, here's a gun, load it, stick it to your head, pull the trigger. Not too many people would do it, you know? Not that you should do that. There's people that are, you know, that troubled. That they, you know, most people that do it, you know, it's just, you know, a moment of passion, really.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
it's a finale. You know, you don't get another chance.
Right.
But everyone can survive. And I think the one thing that I learned and taught myself was mindfulness.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I mean, what I did, and it's funny, when I got out of prison, I saw a show on Vipassana meditation, Buddhist meditation, and I said, that's what I did in there. I had no idea, but I just sat there, and I just let my mind go. And I went through my whole life. I started from when I was young, and I tried to remember my whole life and everything that had happened, and I just let it go. And I just went through it, and I did that day after day after day. And I cried, and sometimes I even had a chuckle or two, and sometimes it was, you know, but it was heavy. It was very, very heavy. And then finally came to the point, and I said, well, you know, whatever happens to me while I'm in this body, wherever I'm kept, I have to do something. I have to heal this mind and this wounded spirit.
Yes.
Because, you know, this is not all there is. You know, it's, you know, it's, you know, I always had the faith that this is not the only life. And, you know, I had to do something. Because just like through life, we carry our childhood with us, and we carry all everything that we've learned and all the impressions with us from the life. Well, the time of death, we'll carry what's there with us again. So
exactly.
It was important to me. You know, it was important to try to change from the inside.
And I know that within mindfulness, you have this sense of radical self-acceptance. Did you find before being able to purge and let things know that you go, you had to put yourself through a journey of self-acceptance or acceptance of what has been or what is?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Because, you know, and it's a matter I was ready for that stage of life. And to be honest with you, addicts, no matter what age they are ready for that stage of life. And I call that stage of life finding your life purpose. Because, you know, when we're young, we're interested in pleasures, right? Partying and, you know, sex and hanging out with friends and going to the movies. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like it's our immature stage where we want what feels good. Well, we get a little older and we get this passion for having an identity, don't we?
Yes.
Right now, it's like, okay, you're a mental health care worker, and you do a lot of good, and you're a radio host, and some people are doctors, and they identify, I'm a doctor, and I study this and that, and I specialize, or lawyer, or a businessman, or musician, an artist, or work, whatever it is. That's our identity. Especially men, when they get together, what do they ask each other, right? Oh, so what do you do? You know, did you see the game last night? I mean, you know, a lot of times it is difficult for guys. You know, to get as deep as women, you know, they find it easier to just talk, you know. But when one gets a little older, if you get a little wisdom through experience, then comes that age-old question, who am I? How did I get here? What will give my life meaning? Right? So now we're looking for the life purpose.
Yes.
We feel a need for higher truth. So we start investigating philosophy, religion, spirituality, you know. You know, I mean, we can understand how we feel, but what we feel without having background and education is only, you know, it's only useful to a certain degree, right? You know, we need a bit of background, you know, or a revelation, as it's called, right, to stimulate our thought process.
Yes.
You know, and give us something to grasp onto to be able to begin to climb the ladder, really, of self-knowledge.
Yeah. And so this is, in essence, how astrology kind of fits into your healing journey, the development of your book. And you talk about higher truth. And so during the break, during our first break, we gave you my information.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to translate that and give us an overview of what something like that would look like if someone sat down with you?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, your chart's an interesting one. You know, you're a very emotional person, very heartfelt, very
true.
Intuitive.
You know? Very
you know?
True.
And I'm sure you'd be a great, you know, and you're in the right occupation, obviously. I mean, if you're an actress or a dancer or, you know.
Wouldn't fit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, but, you know, I can see, you know, extremely emotional. And it's you're also very charitable,
yes.
Talented, and boy, can you talk. I mean,
oh.
You're talking on the show, but I was just, you know, blown away with what a speaker you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
What a speaker, what a communicator, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, six planets all in the sign of Leo at the time of your birth. And
wow.
Five of them, if you're used to Western astrology, would think they were in Virgo. But if you ask any, if you know an astronomer in any observatory on the planet Earth, and you ask them where all the planets were at the time of your birth, he would give you the exact same information that any Vedic astrologer would give you.
Okay, and so that's the sign of a Leo instead of a Virgo?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
This whole time I've been told I was a Virgo.
Yeah, well, yeah, but remember, it's not a matter of relating to a sign. It's a constellation of stars.
Oh, okay.
The planet in the signs and houses and utilizing the system allow us to understand a person's path.
Wow.
You know, I mean, many of the ways that people are so worried about things, you know, you have, you know, some very powerful, should we say, energy in that one house. And it will bring you many opportunities. You're going to enter the best period of your entire life in January of 2019, for 16 years, I'll hear from you. I know it.
Well, that sounds really, really good. I appreciate you doing that because I was really interested in seeing kind of how you work with people, the type of information that you share. And I know, of course, if we met more, you would be able to do more accurate of a reading. But no, I think with what you shared, you were spot on. I agree wholeheartedly with a lot of the things that you said, and I look forward to 2019 now.
and the personal stuff, I mean, that's not for the air. I mean, I can
be, absolutely.
You know.
You know? No, you're
so,
fine.
Yeah, all right.
So now we have about maybe 2 minutes left in our show, and I want you to talk a little bit about both your book and the fact that you're an animal rights advocate and a director of a horse rescue organization.
Uh-huh.
And I know that that does a lot of good work in terms of the healing process. So if you could share within 2 minutes what you do with that and then leave us with a message for our audience today, that would be great.
Okay. Well, you know, what I'm doing now, you know, as far as, you know, the work that I do, it's just I feel that the only pleasure that I found at this point in life is helping others, is seeing, you know, it's helping another person to get a leg up, to help
mm-hmm.
their lives, and to, you know, and I started rescuing horses kind of by accident, you know. I mean, I lived in New Mexico with my wife, and we rescued some dogs, and, you know, I mean, just kind of people found out we were quite compassionate and started leaving animals, puppies and things in front of our gate, you know.
Absolutely.
And we started rescuing. But when we came to Florida, we saw that, you know, there was a lot of need, and we started rescuing horses. And we just feel it's a great way to teach compassion as well
okay.
as show it. But, you know, to be able to teach compassion for all, you know, as well. So, you know, when I wrote Tempting the Devil in the Name of God, the Heavy Hand of Fate, one month, where did you get that thing? Well, I had already gone into the spiritual path, and I fell off the razor's edge.
Mm.
And that is why they're tempting the devil in the God. You understand?
Yes, right? I do.
That,
I
the
do.
Heavy hand of fate came down on me pretty strong. But
yeah.
I do detail also my recovery, you know,
okay.
and my coming back to the world, and my, you know, and anyone and everyone, if they desire to be happy in life. They desire to be satisfied. They desire to find some success. Then should know that all the happiness and ability to, so we say, be joyful resides within you.
Absolutely.
Okay? It's a matter of bringing that out. And to do so, we must find ourselves the right kind of association. We must get ourselves on a path to healing physically, mm-hmm. emotionally, spiritually. And at that point, we begin to find that our life purpose is actually not related to just eating, sleeping, you know, having sex and getting things at all.
Yes. It's
related to having some happiness, some self-satisfaction, and to beginning to understand our own divinity and where we are in relation to the Supreme Divinity.
Wow. Thank you so much for that, Mr. Beckman. Well, unfortunately, we have come to an end of our show, and I thoroughly enjoyed talking with you today about your book and your outstanding, incredible, uplifting journey. I just want to thank you for sharing your story with our listeners today, Mr. Beckman, and I hope you'll join us again soon.
Oh, it'll be my pleasure, Commission. Thank you so much for having me on, and I wish you continued blessings in your life and everyone out there.
Thank you so much. Join us next month where we will be talking about healing women, November 14th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you enjoyed our show today, write in and tell us about it on hccnquestions@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening to Healing Conversations with Kamish Nunley, where we believe what makes you vulnerable also makes you beautiful. Till next time, take care.